Hello, and welcome to another episode of History Hack. Alex and I are bouncing off the walls, but I'm going to leave her to bounce some more and tell you exactly who we've got on.
All my dreams have come true today. You know, I've wanted Formula One for ages. We have Formula One, we have motor racing, we have a public speaker and author, but Mark Gallagher is Mr. Formula One. He's previously been with Jordan, Red Bull, Cosworth. He runs a podcast for himself at the controls about Formula One, which, if you haven't tuned in and listened to that, do because it's brilliant. But he's here today to talk motor racing and history with us. He and I have already had like a massive behind the scenes, like loving over Mika Häkkinen, who was my obsession when I was a teenager. Mark, welcome.
It's so great to be joining you today. Really, thanks so much for having me.
Let's just deal with this. Why are you booing Häkkinen?
Because I'm not a Häkkinen fan, I'm really sorry. Boo.
Why?
Get off. He's awesome.
I'm a Kimi Räikkönen fan.
Oh.
Well, it's just as well you don't invite him on the podcast because he is a man of very few words.
Yeah, it would be
That's
just deathly silence.
that is fine for me. I can, as long as he's on the camera, I'm good with that.
Ah, okay. He's getting quite old now, Kimmy.
Oh, I don't mind. He can
You
get as
don't
old
mind?
as he
Okay.
wants.
Oh, okay, fine.
I just loved Häkkinen because he was so zen for the whole of his career. Apart from possibly, I remember the German Grand Prix where he got rammed off the grid at the beginning when they went round the first bend, and it was Coulthard's fault. And I hated Coulthard forevermore after that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was it.
DC's a very nice guy, you know.
I know, but it was just that was I have to admit at that point I was a very young teenager, and you know, like you're once the axe of judgment has fallen, that's it. That was like he went in a pile with E17, not being as good as take that. It was like you are my enemy. No, I love that Häkkinen was just so zen, and just that you could be in such a hyper masculine sport without being just really misogynistic and stuff. He just seemed like a permanently nice guy.
Do you
He's
know
an
what?
incredible
guy, actually. He's still a very impressive guy to work with, and we do a podcast each month, a Mika Häkkinen podcast, and the stories that he comes out with, I mean, he thinks they're quite boring, and then he just lands us with some jewel of a story that no one has ever heard before, and he's such a fun guy to work with still.
Oh, you
Isn't he
should bring
rally
him on
driving?
here.
Yeah, I should try and do that, shouldn't I? I need to get him to tell us something from history that he's interested in. I've never asked him about that. Maybe it's time that I asked him about some Finnish history.
If you could get me Robert Kubica on here, I would be eternally grateful.
Robert Kubica. What's the Robert Kubica fandom about?
Because he is my fellow brother. Not literally brother, but my Polish brother.
Oh, I see. Oh, I see. Right. Oh, now I'm with you. So I went to Warsaw with Mika Häkkinen, and I'm going to mention Mika a couple of times. I went to Warsaw with Mika 2 years ago, and we did a press conference. And the only questions we got were about Robert Kubica. No one was interested in Mika.
I'm
They were
so
like,
sorry.
they were basically, what do you think of Robert Kubica? Is Robert Kubica faster than you, Mika? I mean, we came out of the press conference, and Mika was like, why didn't they just bring Robert Kubica here to do the press?
Oh, Poland, you failed. You had Mika
Yeah.
Häkkinen and you asked him nothing of interest. You failed, Poland.
Do you want to know why? It's because he's the first Polish race car driver, Formula One, and it was so amazing for Poland to go, wow, look, we are in Formula One for the first time ever. It was incredible.
Yes, and actually, it led to something that historians have not actually picked up upon, which is that Poland actually invaded Hungary. Just a few years ago. And this was because Robert Kubica was racing at the Hungarian Grand Prix. And when we turned up, the entire city had been taken over by Polish fans. And the racetrack was just one massive Polish flag from the start finish line all the way around the track. It was just amazing. All I can say is that Polish fans, when they get behind a national hero, watch out the rest of the world. It is amazing. They were fabulous.
I love
Let's do
it.
the history because otherwise we're just going to sit here and yap about our favorite drivers. But yeah, get Mika on and we'll talk about like Formula One in the 90s because
Okay,
that was
cool.
like, oh, I loved it. I knew the spec of every engine. Oh, it would be brilliant. Right. Okay. Anyway, we're here today because we're going to talk about the Nazis and motor racing and Mercedes-Benz and how, because we all know the Nazis got their grubby little mitt into everything and motor racing. was no different. But let's go back a bit further than that. Tell us a bit about motor racing during the interwar years. It's not just about racing cars, is it? It's already a massive enterprise.
Yeah, no question about it. But clearly what happened was the First World War had the impact of really developing technology, and particularly motorized technology. So all of a sudden the car, which was already massively interesting to people in the, you know, prior to the First World War, it took, went on to a whole new level after the First World War ended. And so you had major French manufacturers, British manufacturers, Italian manufacturers, all vying to create the best technology. And of course, the best way to prove that was through motor racing. So you had people like Enzo Ferrari, who would go on to establish the very famous Ferrari brand after the Second World War. He was actually racing. He was a driver himself, and he was racing, and then he was entering Alfa Romeo sports cars. So in Italy, Enzo Ferrari was building his career in those kind of formative years between the First and Second World War. And then as you move towards the late 20s and into the 1930s, you have not just the giants of Europe in terms of car manufacturers, but also you have the Americans having come in. Of course, Henry Ford famously, you know, developing production techniques that enabled mass production, much faster, much more efficient mass production of cars. So all of a sudden, the car industry just accelerated in an extraordinary way, and there was a trajectory of sort of industrial growth there, which, I mean, every government in every country was really keen to get behind, because clearly it meant jobs, it meant growth, it meant wealth for the economy, and Germany was no different. And so when the Nazis came to power, there's no question that it was already established that the car industry was going to be an area of huge interest for them, and also that motor racing, as a way of promoting your industrial strength in terms of car manufacturing, was going to take kind of center stage in terms of the marketing, if you want to call that, of what they were going to be doing.
I think Johnny Dyer will not forgive me if I do not interject with the anecdote about how the prancing horse for Ferrari is based on a World War One flying ace. There you go, Johnny. Done. We can move on now.
You can tick that box.
Yep.
Okay, good.
So racing success reflects commercial success during the period, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, we still have the saying in racing circles that if you win on Sunday, you sell on Monday. I'm not sure that that's the case really anymore. There's still often a debate about that. But I think if you go back to those interwar years, there's no question that there was so much prestige attached to being able to go out and win motor races, be it the major Grand Prix, the Grand Epreuves, as they were called, the major Grand Prix events, or even sort of local events. So the reality was that the car manufacturers knew that this was an extremely good way to promote your brand and give your salesman something to talk about, and also to prove your technology. And I think actually that technological proving, which is still very much relevant today, is something that the car manufacturers locked on to at an early stage, because if you can build a car that lasts for a long time under the most arduous of circumstances, that can be driven at vast speeds, basically what you're saying to the public is, if it can survive this, it can certainly survive you driving it to work or doing the school run or whatever you want to do with it. So there is a lot of technological innovation as a result of motor racing. And this is why companies like Mercedes-Benz and Auto Union then decided to embrace the sport and, in the case of the Nazi era, secure some backing from the German government.
Speaking of, Hitler is a petrolhead, isn't he? We know where this is going to lead in that case because of the Nazis' love of propaganda.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I've read a couple of books where they describe Adolf as being a, you know, a petrol head. I mean, I think what's clear is that he recognized that there was a lot of prestige to be had from arriving at events in the right kind of car. And he had a good friend who owned a Mercedes dealership in Munich, and he had already purchased a couple of cars from him. And actually, while he was in prison following his failed putsch, he actually ordered a brand new Mercedes-Benz so that when he came out, he had a very grand car to, you know, attend future meetings, etc. So there's no doubt that right back into the 1920s, Adolf Hitler was aware of the fact that it was good to turn up in the right machinery, and he seemed to have a preference for Mercedes-Benz cars, and of course that then translated into what they subsequently signed off in terms of financial aid to both Mercedes-Benz and Auto Union in the 1930s for Grand Prix racing.
So what is the difference between, let's say, the Berlin Olympics and what they can draw or gain from hosting that and motor racing?
Well, I think when people talk about sport in Nazi Germany, very often the Berlin Olympics gets mentioned because it was such a massive global event. And of course, the Olympic Games attracts, you know, competitors from all over the world. And there were a number of very sort of kind of epic moments during those Olympic Games. Famously, the black American runner, Jesse Owens, winning gold in the 100, 200 meters races, also the 4x100 meter relay and the long jump. And of course, this completely went against the Nazis' idea of kind of Aryan supremacy. They had this black American athlete turn up and beat everyone, and Adolf Hitler himself was there to witness that. So from a propaganda point of view, actually the Berlin Games, which was supposed to be a huge coup for the Nazi party, in some ways backfired on them. And there were other examples of kind of sporting controversy during that time. England playing Germany, for example, and the England team being required to give the Nazi salute. That was at the Olympic Stadium in 1938. But what made motor racing, I think, much more important in terms of a kind of a sporting insight to Nazi thinking was the fact that there's technology involved. And the one thing that we know from the 1930s is that there was a rearmament program going on in Germany, and the fact that companies like Mercedes-Benz and Auto Union and other manufacturers were able to use their research and development budgets to create great engines and great transmissions and great suspension systems and train their engineers in these high-end technologies became an extremely important weapon in many respects. And so you had people who are involved in the design and manufacturing of the racing cars actually also involved in other projects to do with the rearmament program, making sure that the German military would have the best trucks and cars and tracked vehicles and essentially have the hardware necessary to launch the military campaigns when they began in 1939.
I mean, you're talking about the more sinister side of the incorporation. Tell us about Ferdinand Porsche.
Yeah, so Ferdinand Porsche, you know, here's a brand name today that, you know, people all over the world aspire to own Porsches, or maybe, I don't know if everyone aspires to own one, but anyway, certainly a very famous name. But Ferdinand Porsche actually started as a designer involved in the First World War, designing giant artillery transport equipment, and he subsequently would work on the rearmament program himself in terms of design engineering. Now, he worked for Mercedes-Benz in the 1920s. He actually fell out with Mercedes-Benz, bit of a power struggle there in 1928. And he then created his own design consultancy. And his design consultancy was contracted by Auto Union to develop the Auto Union Grand Prix cars, which became extremely successful. Not quite as successful as Mercedes-Benz, but certainly very successful all the same during the 1930s. And at the same time as Ferdinand Porsche was working on these racing programs, his company was also providing design consultancy into the German military in terms of, again, the tracked vehicles and all the transport equipment that would be necessary to move the military around during subsequent campaigns. So, you know, Ferdinand Porsche in the 1930s was doing what so many business people were doing, which is simply trying to find great contracts to work to. And some of the greatest contracts that were out there were to do with the creation of the military apparatus that the Nazi party were aiming to bring to bear in the subsequent campaigns that they were going to launch.
So how were Grand Prix drivers regarded in Nazi Germany?
I think it's not too small a point to say they were regarded as kind of real superheroes, because these cars were not, I mean, we're not talking about slow cars. We're talking about cars that were capable of doing speeds of up to 200 miles per hour, which in the 1930s on very, very skinny tires and brakes, which were, you know, state of the art at the time, but nothing like what we have today, of course. I mean, you're talking about machinery with a huge amount of power, drivers who were completely fearless, and fearless in the sense that, quite frankly, here was a sport where if you had a decent accident, you weren't going to walk away from it. You were going to lose your life. And there were a lot of fatalities. I mean, fatalities in some cases in multiple races over a weekend. So you'd have the main race, you might have a support race. There'd be fatalities and people would just continue with the racing. So the reality is it was kind of almost an accepted part of the sporting environment. So when you had a driver who would go out there and win multiple Grand Prix and then win the world, win the European Championships, which they had during the 1930s, these guys took on real positions of superstardom. And of course, they then had the support of the car manufacturer behind them, in the case of Mercedes-Benz or Auto Union, promoting them. So they were being used for all the PR and the appearances. And then on top of that, you had the Nazi Party also using the propaganda benefits of having particularly German drivers racing and winning in their machinery.
I feel as well, it's like a progression on from the worship that was levelled on German pilots in World War One, isn't it? There's a lot of parallels, obviously with developing types of media, but it's the same kind of adulation transferred onto motor racing drivers.
Yeah, it very much so. And actually, it's interesting you say that, because actually, if you look at Formula One when it began, so the Formula One as a category of racing began in the 1940s, but the Formula One World Championship, as we know it, for World Championship for drivers, was established in 1950. And very often when you look at the drivers and the people who are around in racing in the 1950s, this was the post-Second World War generation, and there are a lot of parallels drawn between the kind of fighter pilots of the Second World War and the racing drivers in Formula One of the 1950s. And you only had to look at someone like Damon Hill's father, Graham Hill. I mean, Graham Hill looked like he could have been a Spitfire pilot in the Second World War, and he wasn't. But, you know, but the point is that there was a kind of the same ethos, that kind of, you know, huge bravery, huge courage, the fact that you mightn't come back. You know, you leave the pit lane, you mightn't return to the pit lane at the end of the race, you might lose your life. So there was that, that became part of the mystique, and I think the romanticism of Grand Prix motor racing, both in the 1930s and subsequently after the war.
Tell us, who was Bernd Rosemeyer?
So Bernd Rosemeyer was one of the leading drivers of that era. He was German. He won the European Championship. So this is like the equivalent of Formula One today, but he won the European Championship, driving championship in 1936. In 1937, of the 12 Grand Prix that Mercedes-Benz and Auto Union competed in, Rosemeyer won 4 of Auto Union's 5 victories against Mercedes-Benz. And this is a really important point, is that you had these two German teams. You had Auto Union, you had Mercedes-Benz. And so whilst they were both kind of promoting their own products, they were actually, there was a huge rivalry between them. So Bernd Rosemeyer was kind of the superstar for Auto Union. He then went on to kind of elevate himself into a kind of, I'm trying to think of the equivalent, to be like the Beckhams, I suppose. I mean, he went and married someone who was equally famous. He married a lady called Elli Beinhorn. Mm-hmm. Now, she was a very famous German aviator, and she was doing extraordinary things with planes. He was doing extraordinary things with cars. They met at a Grand Prix in Czechoslovakia in 1935. He was actually on the podium. She met him on the podium. It was all a very romantic meeting. They went off and they got married. And wow, they just got adopted by the Nazi Party as kind of great exemplars of men and women in Germany doing great things. Now, this was all quite controversial because, you know, Bernd Rosemeyer was subsequently, and if you read the detail, it looks like he was kind of forced into joining the SS. And this was, you know, Heinrich Himmler personally ordered that he should have SS membership. And it's kind of unclear as to the extent to which Bernd Rosemeyer wanted to do that, because the reality was he kind of had to do what he was being told because of the amount of funding that was being provided to Auto Union by the Nazi Party. And of course, this was all wrapped up together. So it was all to do with power and finance and influence and all that kind of thing. So Bernd Rosemeyer really was with Elli Beinhorn. They were the superstar couple. And then to really kind of seal what became the myth of Bernd Rosemeyer, he was then subsequently killed in January 1938. And he was killed in a pretty extraordinary event where both Mercedes and Auto Union were setting up to prove their cars to be the fastest possible cars that the world had ever seen. So they were doing these high-speed record runs using the brand new German Autobahn. So can you believe it? Bernd Rosemeyer had gone out and driven his Auto Union that morning down the road at almost 270 miles per hour. Now, when, when you think about that number, 270 miles per hour, almost in a 1930s race car, it was extraordinary. And then unfortunately, on the second run, his car suffered a failure. He was killed. And you can imagine it led to, I mean, it led to an extraordinary outpouring of grief in Nazi Germany. His wife, Ellie, wanted to have a private funeral because she felt sure that the Nazis were going to turn it into a big propaganda thing, and she didn't want that to happen. And
naturally they did, right?
And naturally they did. Naturally they did. And she, you know, extraordinarily, she lived to be 100. And she gave some interviews not long before she passed away, in which she talked about what happened back then. And it was very clear that the annoyance that she felt at the way in which her husband's funeral was hijacked by the Nazis never left her. And so that kind of brought the curtain down on them as the kind of jewels in the Nazi crown in terms of, you know, celebrity, a celebrity married couple.
I am going to move on in a minute to non-Germans quite often, but you have just mentioned, and we haven't really covered it. Tell us about the two teams then. You've got Mercedes-Benz, who obviously we all know the name, and then Auto Union as well.
Okay, so Auto Union is effectively Audi. So if you're familiar with the Audi brand, there are four, the logo for that is four interlocking circles. And those four interlocking circles represent four German automotive brands, Audi, Horch, DKW and Wanderer. And what happened was those four brands came together as Auto Union. So Auto Union, based in Saxony, became the kind of arch rival of Mercedes-Benz. And essentially what happened was when Adolf Hitler came to power, you had the chief executive of Mercedes-Benz, a guy by the name of Wilhelm Kissel, and the chairman of Auto Union, who was Baron Klaus von Oertzen. And basically, both these gentlemen were beating a path to the Nazis' door saying, we want your funding. We want your funding for our car companies. We want your funding for our racing programs, because we're going to promote Germany, you know, through motor racing. And both of them were given support. Now, Mercedes-Benz ultimately got a little bit more financial support from the government than Auto Union did. But Auto Union were every bit as much in the frame. And that battle between those two famous brands became kind of the stuff of legends in motor racing history. So setting aside the kind of political connotations, the reality was that from an engineering and a technical point of view, what Mercedes-Benz were doing and what Auto Union were doing at the time was all groundbreaking stuff. And essentially, it led to complete German domination of Grand Prix motor racing for really a six-year period leading up to the start of the Second World War. So they just absolutely washed away all the competition that had previously been there from companies like Alfa Romeo and Bugatti and Maserati and so on. Frankly, they just dominated the stage between them.
That's mad. But we've talked about Bernd Rosemeyer, but it is, I mean, there's a Brit caught up in all of this nonsense. So it's one thing to be a German and be sucked into the Nazi propaganda machine, but tell us about Richard Seemann.
Yeah, so Richard Seemann was kind of, I'm trying to think what the equivalent would be today, the kind of Jenson Button of his time, really. Very good looking young guy, English. He was born in Chichester. He was the son of a very wealthy Scotch whisky businessman, a guy called William Seemann, and he lived a very, you know, a very blessed life, I have to say. I mean, when you read, there's an excellent book that's been published this year by Richard Williams. It's called A Race with Love and Death, and it tells the story of Richard Seemann's short life, but in his 26 years on the planet, I mean, he had an extraordinary time. He had a very blessed childhood and upbringing. His family were extremely wealthy. They lived in very large country mansions. They had properties in London. They traveled extensively. And his passion, unfortunately for his father, who wanted him to become a businessman, his passion was motor racing. And so basically his mum and dad were asked to write out checks so that he could buy racing cars. And using those racing cars, he soon came to the attention of Mercedes-Benz, particularly after a particularly successful season driving his own car in 1936. So essentially he became to the attention of Mercedes the Mercedes team boss, Alfred Neubauer, invited him to test the Mercedes-Benz car at the Nürburgring in Germany. Richard Seaman did such a good job. He was signed up to the team. And in 1937, against the wishes of his mother and father, he joined Mercedes-Benz and began racing for them and excelled in 1938. He actually won the 1938 German Grand Prix. This young English racing driver, you can imagine standing on the top step of the podium, the 1938 German Grand Prix. And controversially, being required to give the Nazi salute. And there's a very famous photograph of him giving that salute. And basically, if you could give a salute that was half-hearted, if you could possibly imagine a half-hearted salute, that was the one he gave. I mean, he basically, it was all he did to raise
his arm kind of limp.
His arm looks incredibly limp. I mean, it's like, oh my goodness, I have to do this. And it's one of the things that Richard Williams talks about in his excellent book is really the uncertainty that still exists over the degree to which Richard Seaman in any way supported the Nazis. And there's nothing that you read or come across that suggests that he was doing anything other than simply pursuing his career in the best machinery that he could get his hands on. So he became an absolute superstar in terms of, you know, British sportsman at the time. And then tragically, he was killed, and this was in 1939, a couple of months before the outbreak of the Second World War. He was leading the Belgian Grand Prix. It was pouring with rain. His car crashed into a tree and unfortunately burst into flames, a big problem in those days with cars exploding in an accident. And he died later that night as a result of his burns at 26 years of age. But the kind of footnote to that story is that, of course, his body was returned to London. He was buried at Putney Vale Cemetery in London, and very controversially, got a lot of media coverage at the time. The biggest wreath at his funeral, apparently it was like 10 feet across, came from Adolf Hitler with a big swastika in the middle of it. And so that you can imagine in 1939, just, you know, 10 weeks before the outbreak of war, that got a lot of coverage. That wreath, by the way, his mother did not allow it to go to the cemetery.
Good. That cemetery, I'm sure that is a cemetery where Kerensky and his wife are, and I think Bruce Ismay, who owned the Titanic, but that's just me being an absolute nerd.
I'm actually really, really horrified that he told me that he died. I'm sitting there thinking, right, you're going to tell this epic story. He is going to survive. He's going to hit Second World War. And then you come out with this.
Yeah, that's motor racing in the 30s. It was batshit crazy.
I mean, this one of the reasons why, you know, and I think we'll probably move on to talk about some of the legacy of that era and how it's relevant today. But one of the things about, for example, Formula One today is that drivers in Formula One today can, you know, if you're good enough, you can have a career that lasts well over a decade. You can race at the pinnacle of Formula One for 15 years, 20 years, and never suffer an injury. Careers back then lasted a very short time because you either gave up before you suffered an injury or worse, or you were killed at the wheel. And so careers were very, very short. And the Richard Seaman story is an extraordinary story, and he is well remembered. You know, there are still a number of Richard Seaman awards for British racing drivers. British Racing Drivers Club, which owns Silverstone, has an award named after him, which is still awarded to this day. So the reality is that, you know, his legacy continues, but my word, he had a short but very brilliant career.
I don't want to ask this question, to be fair, but I am going to. How much money did the Nazis spend on motor racing?
Well, so there's two parts to the answer that, really. I think the first thing to say is that Mercedes-Benz spent about £106 million over the course of a six-year period on Grand Prix motor racing, and Auto Union a bit less, about £80 million. These are obviously at today's figures. But it's important to say that the Nazi party did not provide all of that funding. And I think it's one of the myths that has grown is that these teams were entirely funded by the Nazis. They were not. Simply what happened was the Nazis contributed funding. Auto Union and Mercedes-Benz were spending about 1% of their annual turnover on motor racing. So both those companies were already spending their own Reichsmarks on Grand Prix motor racing, and the Nazis were simply asked to make a contribution. And it looks like, you know, they made a contribution of about somewhere about a sixth of the budget. I mean, in sort of round terms, something about sort of a sixth to a fifth of the budget of those teams was being provided by the Nazi Party. But there's then another kind of grey area, and that grey area comes where, due to the success that those companies were having in motor racing and as car businesses, they were winning contracts from the government for the rearmament program and to build lots and lots of equipment. So there was actually an indirect financial benefit from the contracts and the orders that they were receiving from the government at the time. So it's all, you know, added all together, there's still no question. There was a great deal of money being spent on motor racing in the 1930s in Germany.
Insane. You've touched on it already. Let's start by, tell us about Lewis Hamilton and how the impact of the Nazi period on Formula One was visible even last year.
Yeah, so this is a really very topical because this year, the Mercedes-Benz Formula One team, which until now has been continued to be referred to as the Silver Arrows. So the Mercedes-Benz cars, Grand Prix cars of the 1930s, were known as Silver Arrows, as were the auto unions. So these German cars always ran in kind of their bare aluminium bodywork. So the Silver Arrows has continued up until very much the present day. So all of Lewis Hamilton's world championship titles for Mercedes-Benz have been won under that kind of Silver Arrows name. This year, the Mercedes-Benz team has changed their entire livery to black. And mm-hmm. that's to reflect Lewis Hamilton's campaign in relation to Black Lives Matter. And it's become as we're literally recording this podcast, it's kind of a quite big controversy in Formula One. I've been very fortunate to work with Lewis at an event earlier this year. And when you talk to Lewis Hamilton for a very short period of time, you realize the extent to which racism and bullying has had a big effect on his life, particularly in his formative years. So the Mercedes-Benz team have taken this on board and they have rebranded themselves into the black color scheme this year. And again, motor racing historians pointing out, this is the first time that that livery has changed since 1934.
To be honest as well, though, not only is it that connotation, but God love him, doesn't he? He's got a Boss deal as well. And Hugo Boss, that's again got nasty connotations historically. So I don't think it's that much of a leap for such a statement to be made. And I don't think that it should be regarded negatively.
No, but it's interesting. I think you would both know only too well. On social media, you have this percentage of people who are just nasty, and Lewis gets it in the neck all the time about the fact that he drives from Mercedes-Benz, and look at Mercedes-Benz did in the 1930s and during the Second World War and the Hugo Boss thing. And people just come out with these just ignorant, unhelpful, irrelevant statements about the past. The reality is that the Mercedes-Benz organization today, the Formula One team that Lewis drives for, has absolutely nothing to do with what happened in the 1930s. And actually, when you read the memoirs of people who were involved in Grand Prix racing in the 1930s, people who were fortunate enough to survive the Second World War and then reflect on it, of course, many of them never realized what was coming. I mean, they certainly were aware of what was going on in Nazi Germany, but a lot of the people involved in these programs, they had no idea that they were about to live through the greatest, you know, conflagration the world has ever seen. But it is interesting that today, you know, in the middle of 2020, in the middle of the global pandemic that, you know, has had a big effect on our sport as well, that actually there's a big discussion going on about the history of Mercedes, the history of our sport. And some of that is being used to attack Lewis Hamilton, who is arguably the greatest driver that Britain has ever produced, and certainly at the moment, the dominant figure in Formula One.
You know what? The amount of crap I have taken in the last, since we started this podcast and since I founded a charity, which I don't know how anyone could be pissed off at that. I can only imagine if you upscale that to the level that someone like Lewis Hamilton receives the same nonsense, how you would just be bereft.
Oh, it's extraordinary. And I mean, I'm slightly, you know, middle-aged guy. I mean, social media for me has been a journey like it has been for anyone else. But I just can't understand how people press the send button on some of the things that they post. Of course, most of them are incredibly, anonymous and cowardly. But now and again, I mean, I've got some followers who, you know, on Twitter, who are people who I would know. And I read some of the things that they post about, you know, Lewis and the racism thing and the Black Lives Matter. And you realize that the ignorance that is out there is extraordinary and is really quite profound. And I think this is why going back and reading your history and learning the facts of your history is so important, because it's the best way to educate people about how we got to end up where we are today.
Can I give a tip to these people?
Yeah.
So I'm probably one of the worst people for being an idiot on social media. I'm going to put my hands up for it.
Yeah, so, but you're an idiot in the sense that you post silly things. You're not an idiot in the sense that you post heinous, disgusting stuff that you would never think of saying to someone's face.
I would never do that. But the point is, sometimes my posts can be construed as the dumb person. So what I do is I write it out, look at it and go, no, and delete it. I don't press the send button. It is not that hard to delete a post if you think it's going to be too mean or too nasty.
Well, not only that, but you have to think 99.999% of my followers on social media will never meet me. What does this tell them about me as a person?
And how is it going to affect the mental health of the person that's going to receive this?
Yeah,
I couldn't agree more. It's interesting. I had a personal kind of moment to check myself a few years ago, and I reposted a tweet that a relative of mine had posted, and it was about Lewis Hamilton, and it was actually amusing, I thought. And both my kids came to see me and they said, why did you repost that? Because actually, if you think about it, that's part of the problem. And I went back and I read it and I thought, yeah, I did think that was funny, but in fact it's really not that. It's actually a bit tragic. So, and I deleted it, and I remember thinking, there's a lesson I'm never going to, you know, forget. Before you press the send button, you have to ask yourself, would I want my family members to see that? Would I want to see it in print? If someone put that in front of me in a, you know, if I was sitting in an interview and someone put that in front of me and said, are you proud of that? The reality is we all have a responsibility for setting the tone of conversation that takes place online. And, you know, and I think it's a big responsibility. Unfortunately, it's a responsibility most people choose to ignore, it seems.
This is true. But let's finish on the history. So yes, there was the legacy with the silver car, but what other remnants are there of Nazi influence on Formula One today? Is there anything?
Well, I think there's the reality is that it left a legacy of, in motor racing, of an awareness of just how strong the German motor industry was and the role that it had to play in motorsport going forward. And if you look at the brands that are involved in racing today, Mercedes-Benz, Audi, as I said, came out of Auto Union, Porsche itself, we talked about Ferdinand Porsche. So you have all of these brands still today. They all have a very interesting, very, very colourful history. And in those days, those dark days of the Nazi era, all those companies, you know, were dragged, you know, in some cases voluntarily dragged, and other cases maybe kicking and screaming into getting involved in the armaments, etc. The reality is that I think the legacy of that period was that once the Second World War was done and dusted, that German car industry reemerged very quickly, very, very strongly. And as we know, through 1960s, 70s and onwards, then became like one of the dominant forces in the world today. And again, and ironically, with the Japanese car industry also following the Second World War, both Germany and Japan really went on to dominate so much of the automotive industry in the world for the second half of the 20th century.
I mean, I've just done a new series of War Factories for yesterday, and there's a trailer running now, so it must be on soon. And we actually have got an episode that includes the Volkswagen story, which is the Allies after the war helped trying to get the German economy going again by getting Volkswagen kickstarted. And then yet again, it becomes murky, doesn't it? Because, okay, they had connotations that are distasteful now, but who got it going again after the war? We did.
Yeah, it was an extremely important product, that Volkswagen Beetle. You know, went on to have a very long and successful history right up to the present day. But there's an interesting point on all of that. So I think Adolf Hitler became Reichschancellor end of January 1933, and less than 2 weeks later, I think it was 11 days after he was appointed Reichschancellor, he opened the Berlin Motor Show. And at that opening ceremony, he made two announcements. The first announcement he made was a state-sponsored Grand Prix motor racing team. He said, we are going to have a state-sponsored Grand Prix motor racing team. He at the time thought it would be just one of the manufacturers. they ended up spending the money across two of them. The second thing he announced was the people's car, the Volkswagen, which of course was then subsequently designed by our friend Ferdinand Porsche. So you know, right at the beginning of his chancellorship, Hitler was setting the stage for their return to glory of Germany in motor racing, and then the development of that car, which, as you say, then went on to have a very long life after the Second World War.
It's just been brilliant. Mark, thank you so much for coming on to give us some Formula One history. And we all know they are ghastly and disgusting, but people love hearing about Nazi history and hearing about this stuff. And I think it's been really important to bring it up to date and touch on Mercedes-Benz and touch on Lewis Hamilton and how we deal with sort of connotations now in part. I mean, Mercedes aren't going to close down as a business and go home because some of their past was sordid. So it's how we rectify the past with going forward. And I think the black car is a really good way to do that.
Yeah, it's certainly out in front and beating everyone this year. I think we're going to see Lewis Hamilton win a seventh Formula One World Championship, which will match that of the great Michael Schumacher.
Just not history-based at all. Do you ever think he'll get the respect he deserves?
I don't think he'll get the respect he deserves with a minority of people who I think there is a fundamental racism, and I think there's also a fundamental misunderstanding about Lewis and his cultural influences and the things that make him tick. I mean, he often gets criticized for things which I now realize are some of the reasons why he's such a strong Formula One driver. He has got so many broad interests outside the sport, it actually really strengthens him inside the sport. He's an extremely rounded individual in that way. But I think within the industry, there's no doubt the respect is already there. And I think in the fullness of time, the vast majority of people will come to realize what a complete superstar Britain has had in Lewis Hamilton.
Thanks so much for your input. And come back anytime you like to talk more Formula One history. And bring Mika.
I'll come back and talk. Well, I'll come back and talk more fun subjects about Formula One.
Well, let's talk about some epic drivers in Finnish motor racing history. We don't have enough European content, and there've been some absolutely fantastic Finnish Formula One Grand Prix drivers. So we should do that.
Well, we've got the phrase in racing that to finish first, you have to be Finnish. So that we can drag one of them on the show. I'll go and talk to Mika and tell him that he needs to come and meet you, Alex.
Outstanding. There is a really sad, pathetic little teenage girl story here. Mika was in a horrible, horrible crash in 1996, is it? In Adelaide? Was it 98? Sorry.
No, it was earlier. It was 95.
And I was 11, and oh my God, I was a wreck. I didn't go to school for 2 days. They thought he was going to die. It was awful. And I sent a get well card that I drew myself. I think I painted his car for him, and in one piece, obviously, and sent it to him. And he must have got overloaded because he'd had these thank you cards printed out a few months later in the shape and design of his helmet with like, thank you for your concern. And I got one back and I was very, very happy. In my head, that made us friends.
Well, at least you heard back from him. That was good.
Yeah,
can I just say, I do have to have total respect for him. It's just Raikkonen.
It's just you're shallow and Raikkonen's better looking, right?
Do you know what? I think you've got me pegged right
now. I know
then.
You so well, Alina. No, they're both fantastic drivers.
They are, and I totally agree. I'm only being silly, but I do have total respect for him.
Awesome. Well, then we'll catch up with you soon, Mark.
Good. Thank you so much again.
Join us on Monday when we begin our African American History Week by talking to Pulitzer Prize winning author Annette Gordon Reed. We sat down with her to talk all about her groundbreaking research into Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, who was one of his slaves, many slaves that he owned, and their relationship. So join us for that. It's a really fascinating talk. Don't miss it.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.